I did do a little bit of a Google on the day that you were born, on the 17th of April 1921. So you've got a birthday coming up.
Yes.
I'm not very good at maths. How old will you be this year?
97.
Oh, wow. That is such an incredible age. I love that. So I was just trying to get a sense of the world. I'm like, okay, so I was born in 1970. You know, I have a rough idea. Yeah. You know, I guess music was about to start exploding. There was various things going on. But in 1921, when you were born, George V was king.
Yes.
The first female politician was elected into Parliament in WA.
Yes, she was.
I mean, that's an extraordinary way of, you know, thinking about the world.
Not in 21, though, was it?
Wasn't it? I thought it was, it said 1921.
Oh,
I think it was.
In the State Parliament.
State Parliament. Yes. But,
that's right.
But that's extraordinary to think, you know, how far your life has come, that you're here and that was then. And
yes, because there was, see, we got the vote. In Victoria.
Women.
In, 1910, something like that.
1910, women were able to vote.
Adelaide had the, South Australia had it first.
Did they really?
Australia, yes.
Why do you think that was? Why were they so ahead of their time?
Well, they just had more active women.
Did they?
Sort of fighting for it, really? Probably.
Well, that's a pretty proud heritage to have, isn't it?
It is. See, New Zealand had it first.
They've often been ahead of the pack, haven't they?
New Zealand was ahead. And New Zealand had it first, and then South Australia. And Victoria, I think, was next. But in Victoria, it was because it was Vida Goldstein who was fighting for it. You've got pictures of Vida Goldstein, haven't you?
Vida Goldstein somewhere, yes.
Yes. And I know people call her Vida Goldstein now. When she was active, she was called Vida Goldstein.
Okay,
That's what she called herself.
Okay. Well, before we get on to another woman who was a huge trailblazer and activist for females, who is your mother, I want to just talk about your childhood and growing up. Where did you grow up and what was it like?
Well, I grew up in Essendon in Melbourne because at that stage my father was member for Essendon, state member for Essendon. And when they got married, they went to live, because they believed in living in the seat where they were...
Yeah, representing.
Where they were representing. Mm. So I grew up in Florence Street, Essendon.
What was it like back then? It would be a very different place to Essendon now.
Well, yes and no. Yes, I mean, I can still recognise it. My house she built is still there.
Is it? It's quite a well-known house. Not that one.
It's not a well-known house.
Okay.
The house that she built in West Coburg is better known.
What's the name of that one?
Oh, well, I know what its name was, but nobody else does. She called it Dunara because her grandmother's house was Dunara. But that was in Coonan's Hill in Pascoe Vale South.
Mm-hmm.
And she also designed and built that one. But, she had it.
Your mother did?
Yes. She was always designing houses.
She was pretty extraordinary, your mother, Doris, Doris Horden, who became Doris Blackburn. But just going back to your childhood, so you grew up in Essendon.
Yes.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I had two elder brothers.
Yeah.
And one was 5 years older than me and one was 3 years older than me.
So you were the baby?
I was definitely the kid sister, you know.
Yeah. Mm. What are your memories of, and we'll talk about your dad later, but what are your memories of your mother?
My mother, when I was little, before I went to school, my mother was gorgeous. She was playful and she was she was a caring person. She was a bit like the women who are organic and caring these days.
Like the earth mother type.
That type.
Yes.
And she was that type. She wasn't a cuddly person, but I can remember the pleasure that I had sitting on her knee while she brushed my hair.
Yeah.
But she didn't sort of pick me up and cuddle me.
Yeah.
She wasn't that sort of mother.
No.
She was...
not a touchy-feely, but you could feel her warmth or...
She was a very efficient woman. She was a woman that, as a small child, I had the feeling I could never keep up with her. But she had very strong health ideas. I mean, a bit like they do these days. For instance, I had to wear boots when I was a child. My brother's leftover boots, because I had fairly weak ankles. So she put me in boots, and I always went to her with boots. And things like that, you know.
What other things do you remember about your mum, or that, you know, that felt bit different to others?
I remember... oh, she was different to other people in a way, because she was interested in the outside world. She wasn't... She wasn't first and foremost a domestic woman, although she could do things. I mean, she always made... she was a very good cook, and she always made jam, and she bottled fruit and did all those efficient things, you know. But because... well, she was saving money too. She had a... she gardened. She was had a big vegetable garden and trees and so forth. So she always was doing things like that in the house. But she wasn't in the house for the house's sake.
She wasn't so much like a traditional mum, where the very stay-at-home mum. And as you said, the interests were within the household. Your mum was quite different, wasn't she?
She was outside.
She was interested in the world.
She was interested in... well, she was interested in the things my father was interested in, some of which she was. But by the time I was born, she had her own interests more than... she was very interested in children's education and kindergartens and all that sort of thing. And although... and when my father was in Parliament, he was in State House for Fitzroy, which... in 25, he won that Fitzroy seat, and she was... there was a kindergarten in Fitzroy, and she spent a lot of time there. And I can remember that kindergarten and so forth going there.
So she was obviously a very interesting blend. And as a young child, especially living in the day and age that you were, it must have been rather fascinating. And I can kind of understand maybe what you mean by kind of looking up to her, going, "Gosh, how does anyone compete or become that?" Because she was so many things. And obviously, when you were younger, you remember that the feeling of the nurturing side of her. But you were aware. But when you say efficient and interested in the outside world, she was such a trailblazer, and so this, yes, you know, yes. She, you know, was very involved in the... she founded Coonan's Hill Kindergarten.
The only problem was she, for instance... now this will give you an idea of the sort of person she was. She was president of the Mothers Club at the state school, and she organised the women to collect books, and they started having putting the books in a one room that wasn't being used as a library.
Oh, wow.
But the headmaster got rid of it and threw it out the books.
Why?
Because he didn't. He didn't. It wasn't his. He was...
it wasn't his idea.
Old-fashioned, you know, probably. He'd never think of that. You know, she was like that.
She was always... it sounds like she was... I just want to read a little, because I have this fact sheet on your mother.
Yeah.
So Doris, maiden name Horden, and we'll talk about that later. It became Doris Blackburn, who lived between 1889 and 1970. So she went out on the year that I came into the world.
1889,
yes, born, which is extraordinary. So it just... there's a fact sheet on your mum, and it said she joined the Women's Political Association in 1911.
Yes.
Married your father, Maurice Blackburn, who has got a very famous legal firm here in Melbourne, Blackburn and Associates? Yes,
Blackburn.
Blackburn. So she married him in 1914.
It's a partnership, actually. They're all partners.
Yeah. So your mum was a foundation member of the Sisterhood of the International Peace, which later became Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in 1915.
That's still going.
I know. So this is... So she was a foundation member, which...
But her mother belonged to an organisation that ran before that called the Sisterhood of Peace.
Wow.
She joined... Her mother had joined the Sisterhood of Peace in 1915.
Gosh. Do you remember what that actually meant, the Sisterhood of... Like, what did they do?
It was actually... In England, there was an organisation that it was an upper-class organisation, a women's action, peace action group. When the suffragettes were working for things, they were also working for peace.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it all tied in.
Well, because it's off the back of World War...
It was before the...
Before World War One.
It started, but...
But the world was...
Already
peace.
In the war, it was in 1915.
In a lot of turmoil.
And there was a woman called in Australia called Eleanor. Oh, I've got a book of hers. Who was the first woman? Sort of. She wasn't a pacifist in the sense of not doing anything.
No.
She was a peace activist, Eleanor Moore, and I've got a copy of her book. In there somewhere. She'll give you an idea of what the...
Because it's, I mean, when I was, I mean, with this series, I really haven't had much prior knowledge to who I'm going to be speaking to. No. I may get birth dates, but I often don't know much about their lives. So it's really like, you know, for me as an interviewer, it's a very on-the-spot kind of thing.
It is.
The only thing that I did get prior to meeting you, and then we had a brief meeting a couple of weeks ago.
And I'd been to this thing.
And you'd been to a historical meeting and so gave me some notes on your mother. But I had been told that you were part of the, you know, the Horden family.
Yes.
Who, so obviously when I could go, oh, well, I can actually Google this woman because there's an online paper trail, whereas there's not for a lot of other guests that I've spoken to, which is how I'm used to gathering some, you know, knowledge before I come to see someone. But... So the Hordens, I mean, I used to work...
Very big family.
Very big family. I mean, I used to work in the music industry, so the Horden Pavilion was one of our main, you know, music venues. But also, one of my very best friends lives in Babworth House. In Babworth House, which is in Darling Point.
Oh, yes.
Which I believe... So your mother, Doris Horden, her... And correct me if I'm wrong, her... grandfather or great-grandfather was
Anne Horden was my great-great-grand.
She was married
the beginning.
To, that's right, Anthony Horden Sr.
She was
the original Horden.
Anne Horden was married to an Anthony Horden who was a coach builder.
Yes.
And they came in their 20s to Sydney. 1823, I think, came. And she looked around the town. I mean, she's the first few days, and she looked around and she said, these people need clothes. So she was a business... I mean, she was always a businesswoman.
Yeah. But she'd come to Australia or a Sydney in 1823 and looked around and said, right, this lot needs some new clothes.
Well... I mean,
thereabouts,
more or less.
Yes.
Went and had a look. You, I can show you.
Oh pictures. No, that's okay. No. Don't know.
Pictures of that time.
Okay.
But anyway, I've got the book that was written by one of the Horden family, who's a librarian. But she wrote a very good book on. It's called Children of One Family.
Oh.
And it's got everybody in it.
I'll have to read that at some point.
And there's pictures of my mother and my grandparents and all that. And people and what people did and so forth.
Mm.
But she had a number of children.
Mm. And it.
And it. Mm. And she and her husband. And they came in about 1906 or 1806. When Melbourne, no, it would have been later than that.
1823, you said before?
Yes, but they would have come to Melbourne when Melbourne was...
A little
before
earlier.
It was founded. I mean, before, after it was founded, it wasn't founded till 1935, Melbourne.
Uh-huh.
So it must have been after 1835, but it wasn't as late as 1840.
Mm.
Because she came with her eldest son and they bought land in the first land sales in 1808, I think they were, or first or second. And they lived in, they bought land in Flinders Lane and in Russell Street.
Right.
The lower part of Russell Street. And they also bought land in Elizabeth Street down by the Sys Station. Mm. Anyway, that land wasn't disposed of till the 1960s. So they had it was there always, but
before that, before they came to Melbourne, it was Anthony Horden Senior that then ended up in retail and
I suppose Anne probably Anne. Started it. I'll tell you how she started it, because she started making bonnets.
They were the fashionable...
Yes, they were the fashionable thing.
Yeah, tell me that
and
story
she,
again.
She sent home to her father and said, send me £10 worth of material to make clothes and a doll's bonnet in the latest fashion.
Yeah.
Then she proceeded to make doll's bonnets. When the doll's bonnet came, she proceeded to make adult bonnets in the same styles.
Gosh.
And then she put an ad in the... newspaper on the front page with a picture of a bonnet and saying Mrs. Horden has got so-and-so bonnet. So she was a businesswoman.
So, yeah, so obviously, I mean, women in Australia in that time, so it would have been the late 1800s or earlier, I mean, are we talking...
Early 1800s.
Okay, so women over here, I mean... potentially, the you know, fashion and what have you might have been a bit more basic because we're a long way away.
Very basic.
But they, but they would have known a bit about fashion. That obviously bonnets and was fashionable. So
they did. And the other thing is that so many of the people who came out to Australia in that period were younger sons of upper class families, which meant. That they were adventurous types.
I see.
That they were upper class people.
I get it. Because I've always wondered. I thought, why would you want to come when you could be in London? So it was trailblazers and adventurous types that go. This is a new country that we're founding.
That's right.
I read an article. When I obviously knew that there was the Horden connection, and I read an article from 1938, and it was, I think, the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yes.
And it was basically talking about your family, Anthony Horden Senior, but then his sons,
yes,
who then not only went on to build this big retail business in Sydney, but then I think it was the article was saying in 1938. Or thereabouts, they had basically launched the Palace Emporium, I think it was, which at the time, so the article was basically saying this family are icons and almost founders of Sydney. They've almost made Sydney, the city of Sydney, what it is today with this retail business and what they brought to Sydney when they arrived. But they were talking about, so it was just interesting to read an article from 1938, which is obviously seems so far away.
It was still fashionable.
That they were talking about this company, the Hordens, having been around for like over 100 years.
Yes, they had.
And so what they were celebrating was not only their heritage and how much they had created, you know, just this huge empire in Sydney, but also the launch of the Palace Emporium in 1938 or thereabouts in the middle of Sydney was at the time, the biggest retail business in the world.
It took up a whole block.
Yeah.
It was up near Central Station.
That's right. So that's just extraordinary to think.
That's when the first time I went to Sydney was about 1938. It wasn't because, unless
it wasn't because of the opening of
then, because it was the centenary. Yeah. Could have been. But
and the opening of this yeah. new incredible.
But they were originally, I think, in Pitt Street, and they had yeah. another shop in what's the other street?
The George Street or Liverpool?
There's another one, Church. I think it begins with it. Anyway,
I can't remember now.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah,
but.
I just wanted to establish
actually was the beginning of all that. I mean, she was into that.
Yes.
And her sons did take the business, but the eldest son, William, wasn't one of them that was working, working in Sydney, but he came with her to Melbourne and he married while he was in Melbourne and he married Cecilia Horden. She was a Munga, but she married her.
What is a Munga? Excuse my ignorance.
Oh, well, Munga was the name of... Her name was Munga.
Oh, okay.
Her father was a builder.
Got it.
And he was building houses in Melbourne in those days. And they married and they went to live in Darabin, you know, near Ivanhoe. And they were very religious. And he built churches and things and so forth. But he stayed in Melbourne, but his mother and father went back to Sydney.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to continue running the business in Sydney.
Yeah.
And while they were in Melbourne, they left the running of the business to Anthony, who was a second son, I think.
Ah, I see. And that's how the Melbourne...
So the Melbourne people... descend from William.
Yes.
And the...
As does your mum.
Yes.
Yes.
The Sydney people were probably connected.
So it's, I mean, the Horden blood is obviously quite extraordinary because they are and were, I mean, the blood still runs through you, but such founding people, you know, they, you know, which is quite extraordinary.
But the interesting thing is that the Sydney people and the Melbourne people are slightly different people My mother's first cousin was the first in Melbourne, also descended from William, was the first woman to get a law degree in Melbourne.
Gosh.
And
that's what's so amazing. It's like this, because, I mean, I think your mother would find it so wonderful that in the last just couple of years, or even you could say 12 months, with everything that's been going on with world events in terms of, you know, sexual harassment, the Me Too, but women becoming genuinely so empowered and actually men starting to be a bit frightened of doing the wrong thing by them. It's women like from your family and especially your mother that were paving literally the foundation for where we are today and had everything up against them. But then, you know, in the role that you played too, you're the daughter of one of these trailblazing women from a, you know, such a long era ago. And, you know, there would have been lots of sacrifices. You wouldn't have had your mum around, I would imagine, as much as others did. And she would have been different and you noticed different.
She was different. Sort of coming home from school, I mean, she was usually out and I cooked the tea. If she wasn't coming home because she had an evening
meeting,
I learned how to cook meals.
What age were you doing that?
Oh, at 14.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, but my brothers could do all those things. My elder brother wouldn't. He wouldn't soil his hands doing those things. But my younger brother, who was 3 years older, he was magnificent. He could do anything.
You said when I first met you that your mum was a complicated woman.
She was.
Yeah, what do you mean by that? I mean, I can imagine she would have been.
She was a very emotional woman in herself, yes.
Passionate or emotional?
Yes, she was passionate.
Passionate, yeah.
She was passionate about things, but she was a very sensitive person in many ways.
Really?
And her greatest tragedy was losing my baby sister when she was about 40 then.
Yeah.
And she died, and my mother took it very badly. But
that would have been quite, not to take away anything, but I'm just also thinking of a woman of her era having a baby at 40. That was quite old for those times. No, was it not? Wasn't
really, because in those days there was nothing, there was no proper contraceptives.
Oh, okay. So things could happen any time.
So people had big families because
of the stretch of time. Yes, okay.
There was no...
You could have had your first in your early 20s and then your last in the
40s. People were still having 8 or so children. I mean...
Yeah, that's true. People had more babies. What did that baby die of?
A congenital heart disease.
Oh.
So that my mother couldn't have done anything about it.
No.
But... I think she heard when the midwife was there somebody saying the baby had gone, obviously she knew that there was something, and she fought terribly hard to keep that baby alive.
Really?
But I can remember, because I don't ever remember her sitting up, you know, she died when she was... just over 12 months old. Mm. But
did the baby come home?
Oh, yes, she was home.
Okay. So she had it for 12 months at home.
Mm. But I said to her not long before she died, because she never spoke of it. She never mentioned it.
No.
So she was that sort of person. She was quite... She kept her feelings to herself. She was always active, but her real feelings she kept to herself.
She obviously had an ability to say a lot and be passionate, as long as it wasn't necessarily just about her own personal stuff.
That's right.
Been the trailblazer.
She externalised everything. So that when... Because she never spoke of it, which was hard for us as children.
Of course it would have been.
And I said to her, I had an opportunity, because we got very friendly later on.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to say to her, why did she never... Oh, no, she said to me, not long before she died, you didn't talk to me when you were in your teens. And I said, no, I didn't, because I didn't want to... worry you about things to do with sex and so forth, because I thought it would remind you of having a baby, losing your baby. And she said it was nothing to do with losing a baby, it was her sense of failure that she hadn't kept it alive.
Oh, wow.
And that was why she had a breakdown.
Oh, wow.
Which is understandable.
Well, it's... I think people process things different, and then they make a determination, and often they bring that home to themselves, don't they? And they then shame themselves. And when people are not sharing stories, as luckily they are sharing stories and pains more often in your era, and certainly your mother's, but that's not happening. So
no,
you can really,
that,
you can punish yourself for a long period of time.
That's part of the period, isn't it?
That's right.
That people... certain things were taboo.
Right. You didn't have the luxury of talking about things.
They would regard that as you say, a sort of a luxury of they'd say that you shouldn't be
self-indulgent, or you shouldn't be sharing that kind of stuff.
Yes,
but that's...
Also, I suppose she wanted to keep up her model of what she should be like as a mother, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's hard. I think past eras have been, you know, what people think of you was... considered a lot more. I mean, well, look, it's different. I think, you know, people have a hard time now because they're worried about what people think of them on Facebook or Instagram or nonsense like that. You know what I mean? But
yes, exactly.
But I do know that, my mother has grown up particularly worried about what people think about her and not wanting people to know about her personal business. And I know she got that from my nana.
Yes.
But so I think that was part of the world.
I think it was.
But I think I wonder whether it would have been in terms of the high achieving expectations of your mother coming from a family like the Hordens. That's, I mean.
But she didn't come from a rich background.
No.
Because her father had lost his money. I mean.
Right.
I think he had lost his money two ways. One was because he lived it up too well.
Uh-huh.
And the other was...
Sounds like my dad.
That it was a land boom.
Now, it's with utmost respect I am interrupting this beautiful conversation now for a moment to thank my sponsors, Freedom Aged Care. So when I decided to do this podcast series, which really came from a genuine place of feeling like the one generation in our society being talked about the least was actually the one we needed to be listening to because these people have lived so much. So I decided to give an aged care company a go and I chose one that I'd explore during my search to find somewhere for my dad to live. And I instantly loved what Freedom appeared to be about, which was celebrating the lives of their residents, but doing it with a really joyful touch. And I contacted a guy called Craig Flett, who's one of the family members involved with Freedom Aged Care, a guy I'd never met. And in an email, I poured my heart out on why I wanted to do this series. And to my great surprise, he instantly said he wanted to get on board. As he put it, Freedom's residents have together lived a million years of life, a fact that the company is really intensely proud of. So it's become a really beautiful, authentic union, and it's allowed me to get paid for what I love doing, and for them, hopefully, it highlights their commitment to honouring the people who have led long, brave, and interesting lives, and people who deserve not to be forgotten. So now, back to my wonderful guest.
So circumstances changed.
The Melbourne has this history of the land boom, which is very strong part of the history of Melbourne.
Mm.
And so many families will have suffered in the land boom.
Tell me a bit about the land boom at that time.
Well, land boom was... We nearly had it recently. We had almost were on the edge of a land boom.
Right.
And the land boom is the difference between Melbourne and Sydney. Because Sydney didn't go through the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Melbourne, people got... Land became very valuable and people started investing in land and the prices went up and up and people bought these mansions, built these mansions. They're beginning to do it again in a small way. But you know that the mansions in the eastern suburbs, well, that was all part... You've got them in the western suburbs too, but only a few of them. Right. Essendon had some.
And so a lot of the wealthy, kind of younger wealthy, or the, you know, invested in and built these big, beautiful houses. And then
it crashed. It all crashed. That was the land boom.
Yeah.
And in that crashing...
So people with money suddenly had all these big houses and no money.
Yes, that's right. That's what happened.
So that sense of failure.
That's right. And that then... There's that sense of so many families in Melbourne, old families and families that you know are established families. Mm. They've been through that and they've suffered that. And so Bailiffs, for instance, all those people went through the land boom.
Mm.
And I've got a copy of a book on the land boom there and I can show you the list of people who were suffering. And... they just overdid it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they
greed? Greed? Greed or a sense that we're here to...
No,
to develop this new country.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Just that land was cheap. It was beautiful. I mean, the country was beautiful. They bought land and they built mansions.
Mm.
And, you know, we're in the same sort of era now, but they're not quite as big mansions.
No.
But it is the same era.
Certainly not as pretty.
No, but they're similar.
Yeah. And so you became, your predominant, you know, career in life, was it librarian?
Yes,
is that right? So there's always been, you know, everything about you growing up with
always been books.
Always been books and history.
Well, my father loved books.
It came from your father.
It came from my father. My father didn't have much money when he was young because his mother was widowed, and but he always used to go to the Prahran Library. And then when he was married, well, he probably started before he was married, but he also had a thirst for knowledge, and he not only went to the Prahran Library, but he started buying second-hand books. And you could buy books for... You could buy good books for a shilling, and you could buy funny books for sixpence and threepence and
what sort of books did he like? Were they historical or fiction or just anything? Well, it
was mainly historical and biographical, but he liked customs. He liked books on... He loved the sense of people.
Mm-hmm.
His life was built on feeling that he was helping people, the ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't wanting to help himself. He had this sense, because he grew up where a lot of women had nothing, particularly like people that he lived with his mother and their aunts. They had lots of relatives, or none of whom had any money.
Mm.
And he always had the sense of wanting to help people. Mm. And he and my mother worked on that basis. That was what it was all about.
Mm.
And so he started collecting books, and he knew every second-hand bookshop in Melbourne, and he used to take... I often went with him on Friday night to bookshops because it was open on Friday night. And the market used to have books on the ground and some on things.
Which market?
No,
Victoria Market?
The ordinary Victoria Market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vegetable market. They'd also have bookshelves, tables, and we'd buy things there. He didn't like to spend more than 2 shillings on a book. So nearly all the books that we had, he'd been bought for under 2 shillings. And we had 5,000 books.
Wow. Amazing.
And so I grew up helping surrounded my by father books. Sort of mend books, cover books, do everything. I just loved it. And I loved my father. He was, you know, he was a man that I just felt very close to always.
Yeah, yeah.
And so did my older brother. He and I, my younger brother was a more practical person, and he was very like my mother, and they got on well, and my elder brother and I got on better with my father. It's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the same. I'm very close to my father, and I think, you know, I'm the eldest, and my brother's closer to my mother. But you do have an affiliation, I think, and an easy connection with one or the other. And,
yes.
You know, and you have traits, you know, that are from...
And I think my mind, I can understand how my father's mind worked on certain issues.
Yeah.
Because
I've
talked to him about it things like that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your large, large, incredible life.
Well,
it's been fascinating.
I've had a very good life because I found the librarianship is a wonderful profession. And still, even with computers, it is. But I love books, you know, the feel of them, the whole thing.
Yes, me too.
You can do things in so many... Librarians come in all sorts. You can be a special librarian in any field of saying, or you can be a scholastic or something, or you can be a language librarian. You can sort of, it covers so many things.
Probably the stupidest question you've ever been asked, but do you have a favourite book?
Do I have a favourite book? Yes, Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, how beautiful. I love that. What a great, yeah, that's a great. And you know what I think if someone asked me, which is an old book, The Magic Faraway Tree, you know, yes. I'll just never, ever have a more beautiful, excited yes, connection with a book when I was younger.
A lot of
Blush
people and, do about that. I was in the, I belong to the period when they were out of fashion, you know, the school librarians mm-hmm. weren't allowed. I was a school librarian. I wasn't allowed to buy, what's her name?
Enid Blyton?
Enid Blyton.
You weren't allowed to? Why?
Because they were regarded as not very literary.
Oh, really?
I was librarian at St. Catherine's and we weren't allowed to buy Enid
Blyton. Oh, that's so funny. Wow, I don't know what that says about me.
No, but a lot of your generation loved Enid Blyton.
Yes, yes.
So, I mean...
She had a resurgence.
Yes, I know she did. And, I mean, the point is that my niece, who's now in her... Well, she's 73, 74, so forth. She loves Enid Blyton. Mm. I mean, that period. But my period... Well, I was working, as I say, I was working at St. Catherine's 1950 to 55, and that's when they stopped. Enid Blyton was out of favour.
Enid was out of favour. Oh, that's very interesting. I would never have known that.
It is interesting, though, isn't it?
Well, I also I grew up across the road from a library, and I spent a lot of my time and around books, the Brighton Library.
You were at Brighton?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so I totally am with you on the connection to books, and I absolutely love it, and I love librarians, and I... Yeah, I still got, you know, I've been writing a book recently, well, not recently, on and off for the last few years, but I have gone back to the Brighton Library to finish that because I feel that connection with my younger self when I had that pure kind of feeling of, oh, I love stories, I love storytelling, I love history, and I love being surrounded by books. It's really been the perfect place for me to sort of finish this book,
well, actually,
and I adore
it. Well, thing about the Alice in Wonderland thing. Mm. I have no hesitation in saying Alice in Wonderland because as a child I sort of developed an identity with Alice in Wonderland and so it's remained with me always. I still...
What was that identity, do you think? What was that connection that you felt?
Well, curiouser and curiouser, you know. It was curiosity, it's this thing. But I know now... You see, I did philosophy at the university. I did a degree in pure philosophy. Mm-hmm. And Alice in Wonderland and Alice through the Looking Glass, you've got to have the both of them. Mm. The writer, Lewis Carroll, was a lecturer in philosophy in Oxford University. And it's all logic. Alice in Wonderland and Alice through the Looking Glass are facets of the mysteries of life. In the Alice through the Looking Glass, towards the end, Alice is wandering through the woods or something, and she comes upon an old man. Sitting on a gate, and he didn't move, he was sort of sitting on the gate, and you got the sense of the style and so forth, and he was sitting on the gate. He wasn't one or the other, you know. Mm-hmm. he was straddled across the gate, so to speak, so
one leg
in
each,
all sorts of things like that. The Red Queen saying, just difference about direction and things like that comes in Alice through the Looking Glass. But it's all, you can you can get it down to logical problems, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that when I was five or six. But it's the way my mind worked, and it still works that way.
That's so beautiful. You've just inspired me to go and get a copy of,
funny,
of both of them and read them as an adult.
It's funny. Mm. Well, there is a book, an annotated Alice. There's an annotated Alice and there's an annotated Hunting of the Snark.
Mm.
Do you know the snark, Hunting of the Snark?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Well, that's written by Lewis Carroll too.
Oh.
And they're searching for the snark. They sort it with cancer, you know. And something had vanished away, for the snark was a boojum, you see. So, I mean, it was all nonsense, but the whole thing, you know, beautiful. Jabberwocky and all those things, it's all nonsense. But it's nonsense with a reality behind it.
Yes, which is fascinating, isn't it?
And that's what I found fascinating. And I've lived all my life thinking in Alice terms, but it's nothing, I've never done anything.
Mm.
It's just, I play in my head.
Well, that's beautiful.
Does that sound silly?
No, it doesn't at all. No, it sounds beautiful.
You see, I'm not like my mother, who was an activist, because I don't do all those things.
Mm.
I'll go to a demonstration or I'll do something. If I think that somebody ought to do it, I'll do it, but not because I want to. Mm. I never want to do those things.
Mm.
I'd like to thank Freedom Aged Care for introducing me to some of its wonderful residents for this series, who together have lived a million years of life. To find out more about Freedom Aged Care, head to freedomagedcare.com.au.